Okay, let's unpack this. We are taking a deep dive today into, well, it's more than just a band's discography, isn't it? It's like a singular, intensely personal journal set to music.
Exactly. We're charting the career of an artist, Mark Oliver Everett, or E, who basically spent over 3 decades turning, just immense personal tragedy, but also these high concept physics ideas from his family
Right, and just raw, messy humanity.
into a sound that just absolutely refuses to sit still. We're talking about Eels.
The American indie rock institution Eels. And the focus really has to be on E, because he's the sole constant member, the driving force.
Yeah, Eels is sort of the ultimate example of a band as a vehicle for one person's worldview. The musicians around him change, they come and go, but that creative anchor, E himself, he's absolute.
And the sources we're drawing on, detailed biographies, the full discography, they map out this incredible history. It starts technically Los Feliz, Los Angeles, around 91.
But the name Eels came in 95.
Right, 1995. But it's not just a band history, is it? It's really a story about radical personal processing through art.
And the sheer volume of work is kind of staggering. 15 studio albums since the 96 debut.
Wow, 15.
Yeah, and 7 of those hitting the Billboard 200. That consistency is remarkable, but what's maybe even more remarkable is the extreme variability of the sound.
Totally. It swings from alternative rock, fuzzy indie stuff, to even those early kind of unexpected trip-hop moments.
But the core identity, like you said, stays fixed. Eels' music is just so deeply tangled up with these huge themes: death, family, complicated grief, love that doesn't quite work out.
And it's not abstract. It's pulled directly from his own life, often really traumatic experiences. So our mission today is kind of figuring out how this unique way of dealing with chaos created something so resilient, so enduring, and yeah, so musically varied.
And I think that's the hook for you, the listener. This isn't just musician overcomes tragedy. It's about how an artist's deepest struggles run weirdly parallel to his family's really mind-bending scientific legacy.
That's the tension, isn't it? The son of this famous quantum physicist grappling with the chaotic nature of, well, everything. How does that collision shape the art? Let's get into that right from the beginning, the genesis of E.
So, Mark Oliver Everett's family background. It's genuinely unique. It's defined by these like polar
Yeah,
opposites.
on one hand, you've got this intense emotional vulnerability you hear in the music, and on the other,
The absolute pinnacle of theoretical thought. His father was Hugh Everett III.
a name that, if you're into quantum physics, you definitely know. He originated the many worlds interpretation.
Which is, well, it's a heavy concept. For anyone not familiar, the theory basically suggests that every quantum event, every possibility, splits off reality, creating a new parallel universe.
Infinite alternative lives unfolding at the same time. Pretty mind-bending stuff to grow up around.
Totally. So E's childhood has this incredibly cerebral theoretical backdrop. Multiple realities are, scientifically plausible in his house. But then that high concept physics is sharply contrasted by other parts of his upbringing.
Absolutely. You get this real grounding element from his mother's side. His maternal grandfather was Harold Kid Gore.
Ah, the
Yeah,
coach.
a figure of like solid athletic normalcy, a celebrated coach at UMass Amherst, basketball, football, baseball.
It's this fantastic contradiction, isn't it? Quantum mechanics debated at home, and then stories about, coaching 3 different sports, pragmatism versus infinite possibility.
But the moments that really seemed to shape E as a young adult were these sudden, visceral events, things that left literal marks, like his glasses, his trademark look.
Right. Most people probably think it's just style.
But it's not. It comes from this shocking incident when he was a teenager. He was at a Who concert.
Yahoo concert. Okay.
Yeah, and one of those special effects lasers hit him directly in the eye. He's had to wear glasses ever since.
Yeah.
Just this sudden physical intrusion from spectacle.
Wow. That's quite a story and kind of darkly foreshadows the deeper emotional traumas to come, doesn't it?
It really does, because the defining loss came early. He was only 19. His father, Hugh Everett III, died suddenly. Heart attack.
And the detail that just hits you is that Mark E was the one who found his father's body.
Yeah. I mean, imagine that at 19. That's a trauma that just rips your world open instantly. And it's not just something that influences his music. It actively surfaces and resurfaces through the years, sometimes hidden, sometimes very direct.
So before Eels became Eels, E was already trying to make it in music, right? He moved out to California from Virginia in 87.
Yep. And by the early 90s, he actually had 2 major label solo albums out. A Man Called E in 1992.
That had Hello Cruel World on it. I remember that video on MTV.
Exactly, a minor hit. and then Broken Toy Shop in 1993.
And this is when the name E really sticks, but the reason is surprisingly mundane.
Totally practical. Sources say it was just because his first name, Mark, was shared by a bunch of people in his life, causing confusion. So he just shortened it to E.
It's almost funny. Such a simple solution. Very E in a way.
That pragmatic streak, that almost humorous utility, it carries over right into the band's naming, too. When he officially formed the band with Butch Norton on drums and Tommy Walter on bass,
they needed a name. And the logic. Oh, the logic was brilliant.
Brilliantly flawed. They chose Eels specifically so the records would sit right next to his solo stuff in the E section of record stores. You know, E, then Eels. Alphabetical proximity.
Simple. Makes perfect sense.
Until you hit the reality of music retail. E tells this story about going into a Virgin megastore, seeing his solo CDs right there at the start of E, and then just pages and pages.
Eagles, Earth, Wind and Fire.
Dozens of them. Separating his solo work from his band, the Eels records were nowhere near E.
It's perfect, though. A perfect little Eel story. Trying for structure, ending up with beautiful, slightly awkward chaos. So, okay, despite the name Kerfuffle, by 1996, the band Eels is officially launched, and they make a really big splash right away with the debut, Beautiful Freak.
Yeah, this was a significant signing. Eels was one of the very first acts signed to the brand new DreamWorks Records. Remember DreamWorks? Huge deal at the time.
Oh, yeah. Elliott Smith signed soon after, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So Beautiful Freak comes out, and it just clicks internationally, too.
Driven by those huge singles. Novocaine for the Soul, obviously. Susan's House. Your Lucky Day in Hell.
They were everywhere for a bit, and it led to actual awards recognition pretty quickly. They won Best International Breakthrough Act at the Brit Awards in 98.
Which is pretty major for an American indie band. Susan's House especially seemed to hit a nerve, particularly in the UK.
Right. The sources point out its style, that slow tempo, the murky vibe, the distorted spoken word vocal.
It really resonated with the trip-hop sound that was massive in the UK then.
Hmm.
Think Massive Attack, Portishead.
Exactly. So this LA alternative band kind of gets swept up in that UK scene because of that one song's resemblance. Maybe a bit of an awkward fit for E ultimately, but it definitely worked commercially over there.
But even with that early success, instability creeps in pretty fast. The touring for Beautiful Freak was apparently quite grueling.
And Tommy Walter, the original bassist, he quit in September 97.
So an early sign of things to come. E is the constant. The lineup around him is fluid. Change is the only certainty.
And then, almost immediately after that initial burst of success and that first lineup shift,
yeah,
comes the absolute pivot point in the Eels story, the 1998 album Electroshock Blues.
Yeah. E himself just called it a terrible, difficult time, and you hear it. The music is like listening to a raw, open wound.
Because the personal tragedy that was maybe simmering beneath the surface just exploded, a cascade of loss. His sister died by suicide.
And then right in the wake of that, his mother is diagnosed with terminal cancer. Electroshock Blues is him processing these just impossible events in real time through the songs.
It's famously profoundly dark. I mean, the themes are right there, mental illness, cancer, suicide, death. The lyrics are brutal, almost like documentation rather than poetry.
If you look at the tracks, Climbing to the Moon deals so directly with his sister's struggles. The medication is wearing off. I mean, the titles alone tell you. It's harrowing stuff.
But essential listening, if you want to understand E's whole creative drive.
And what makes the album feel so complete in its sadness is how it connects back to earlier losses, too. The song Baby Genius.
That's for his father, Hugh Everett III.
Right. It brings his father's death back into the frame, alongside his sister's suicide and his mother's impending death. He was facing the virtual dissolution of his entire immediate family in just a couple of years. It's unthinkable.
And yet, somehow, in the midst of all this darkness, the recording process attracted some amazing talent. John Brion worked on it.
T-Bone Burnett, Michael Simpson from the Dust Brothers.
Yeah, it's like the weight of the material drew people in. And despite the heavy themes, it still found this cultural traction.
The single Cancer for the Cure, which is surprisingly driving, almost manic, ended up on the American Beauty soundtrack in 99.
Bringing that incredibly personal pain into mainstream Hollywood.
But the real world cost was huge. The sources confirm part of the U.S. tour for Electroshock Blues had to be canceled.
Because his mother passed away.
Yeah. The art wasn't separate from the life. It was completely bound up in the ongoing consuming grief.
So after the absolute emotional devastation documented on Electroshock Blues, E clearly needed, well, he needed a shift, a conscious artistic choice to step back from the abyss.
which leads us to Daisies of the Galaxy in 2000. It felt like such a deliberate, almost defensive move towards something lighter.
Yeah, this is where that parallel worlds idea maybe starts showing up musically, even implicitly. He's using the album format to, like, compartmentalize the trauma, to actively move away from it.
He had that great quote comparing the two albums. Electroshock Blues was the dreadful phone call in the middle of the night.
That nobody wants to answer.
Right. And Daisies of the Galaxy was engineered to be the hotel wake-up call that says your love and breakfast is ready.
It's just instantly warmer, more acoustic, maybe a little fragile still, but definitely lighter.
And even with that shift and the fact it was recorded mostly in his basement, very intimately.
Mm-hmm.
He still pulled in great people. Peter Buck from REM is on there.
Grant Lee Phillips, too.
But we have to talk about the big single from that album, Mr. E's Beautiful Blues, because the story behind it is classic E.
Oh, yeah. That track, co-written with Michael Simpson again,
It
was absolutely not supposed to be on the album.
Right. E didn't want it. But the record company, Polyore, they heard it and basically insisted. They knew it was a hit.
So E, being E, finds this perfect passive-aggressive compromise.
He lets them include it, but only as a quote-unquote bonus track, listed separately on a sticker on the cover.
And crucially, separated from the rest of the album by 20 seconds of silence on the CD.
It's his way of saying, okay, you get your single, but it exists in its own little universe, walled off from the actual album. Mm. Brilliant.
But E being E, he can't stay in that lighter space for long. The pendulum swings back pretty quickly. 2001 brings Souljacker.
Yeah, if Daisies was the gentle breakfast call, Souljacker is way heavier. Louder, more rock, grittier, moodier, back towards the fuzz.
And a lot of that shift seems connected to his collaborator on that record. Souljacker is notable for the heavy involvement of John Parrish.
The British musician and producer worked a lot with PJ Harvey.
Exactly. Parrish co-wrote most of the songs, and you can hear his influence. It's darker, more rhythmic, more driving. It really textures that album differently.
And then just 2 years later, 2003, we get Shootin' Any, which E later described almost as a palate cleanser.
Yeah, like a break he took before diving into the next big project. It sounds like it, too. It's raw, immediate, recorded super fast, live in the studio in just 10 days.
Yeah, 10 days.
Just a snapshot. Let's just play, not overthink it. Which, maybe, was necessary prep for what came next.
Because what came next was, for many people, his magnum opus. Blinking Lights and Other Revelations in 2005. The ambition level here was just huge.
Colossal. The scope alone. 33 tracks, a double album, their first for Vagrant Records. Yeah. He apparently felt he had maybe one massive artistic statement left in him.
So he just poured everything into it. All the accumulated ideas.
Pretty much. It was meant to be his big final word in a way.
And the complexity, the ambition, it attracted this incredible, almost historical lineup of collaborators.
Seriously. Tom Waits is on there. Peter Buck came back. John Sebastian from the Love and Spoonful plays harmonica.
It's like this gathering of legends to support E's deeply personal story.
And because the music itself was so dense, so intricate, it led to this really fascinating shift in how they presented it live. The Eels with Strings tour.
Which totally redefined vulnerability for them, didn't it? E on acoustic guitar or piano.
Backed by an actual string quartet. Instantly strips away all the rock noise. He had Alan, Big Al Hunter on bass, and Jeffrey Leister, the Chet.
Ah, the Chet. The multi-instrumentalist genius. Mandolin, musical saw, pedal steel. These quirky, beautiful textures.
And trading the distortion for that delicate, sometimes bizarre chamber sound just made the emotional core of the lyrics completely unavoidable.
It was captured perfectly on that live CD-DVD, Eels with Strings, live at Town Hall. Such a specific, powerful moment.
And that whole kind of retrospective phase seemed to wrap up around 2008. You get the greatest hits, Meet the Eels, Central Eels Vol. 1, and the B-sides collection, Useless Trinkets.
Right. And the tour that followed, An Evening with Eels, was even more stripped back, just E and the Chet.
Playing songs from across the whole catalog, but with the Chet actually reading bits from E's autobiography on stage between songs.
It's such a meta way to tour. Blending the memoir, the music, the performance, really hammering home the biographical nature of the whole project. Okay, so we've tracked this incredible, sometimes chaotic journey through tragedy, experimentation, the darkness of Electroshock Blues, the sheer scale of Blinking Lights. Where does he go from there, especially given the pace he works at?
Well, the output stays relentless, but around 2009, E finds this new way to impose some structure on it all, maybe as a reaction to the sprawl of Blinking Lights. He decides on this rapid-fire trilogy of concept albums.
Right, the trilogy focusing on lust, loss, and redemption, sequentially.
It's amazing how quickly they came out. First, 2009, you get Hombre Lobo. That's the Desire album.
Hombre Lobo, Wolfman in Spanish, which apparently directly referenced his look at the time.
Yeah, he'd grown this massive beard while writing the song Dog-Faced Boy. So the album has this restless, kind of primal, animalistic energy running through it, reflecting that theme.
And that album gave us one of the most unexpected, perfect soundtrack moments in recent memory. The track Fresh Blood.
Oh, yeah, becoming the theme song for the HBO docuseries The Jinx.
That dark, driving, tense piece of music just perfectly scoring this chilling true crime story. It really cemented the album's vibe.
Then, literally the next year, 2010, comes part two, End Times, the Loss album, focused entirely on broken love, the aftermath.
And fittingly, it sounds much more intimate, almost isolated, recorded mostly on just a four-track recorder, right?
Exactly. It's got this beautiful lo-fi vulnerability. And the sources say, reflecting that deep personal focus, he initially didn't even plan to tour for End Times.
Like it was just his private document of collapse, maybe just for him and the diehard fans.
But the story needed its ending. So Redemption arrives just months later, still in 2010, with the final part, Tomorrow Morning, the Redemption album.
And this one signals a definite shift up in energy. He announced a world tour with this one, the first since 2007.
Yeah, back with the full Rock Band setup, the Chet, Cool G, Murder on bass, Knuckles on drums, Peeboo on guitar. It completed that emotional arc. Raw desire, crushing loss, and then finding some hard-won clarity.
But finishing the trilogy didn't mean slowing down. The output just kept coming, proving E had basically found this endless well of material in just living his life and documenting it.
Absolutely. 2013 brings Wonderful, Glorious, and this one leads to that amazing pop culture moment of political satire.
The Cold Dead Hand video.
Right. Released through Funny or Die, it perfectly captured that Eels miss of serious commentary and just absurd humor.
Featuring Jim Carrey taking over vocals for me.
Doing this satirical country song lampooning American gun culture, specifically calling out Charlton Heston's Ghost, all set on a fake hee-haw style show. It was brilliant.
Just brilliantly weird. And the albums kept flowing. The cautionary tales of Mark Oliver Everett in 2014 on his own E-Works Records. That sounded intensely reflective.
Then 2018 gave us The Deconstruction. Lyrically, that one really seemed focused on rebuilding after big life changes. Looking back, taking stock.
And sonically, The Deconstruction felt like a real summary of his whole career up to then, didn't it? It touched on orchestral pop, power pop, psych rock, indie rock.
Yeah, it was a really confident sound, acknowledging the past, but looking forward.
And he's kept up the pace since. Earth to Dora in 2020, and then Extreme Witchcraft in 2022. That one felt significant.
Definitely, because it marked his first production collaboration with John Parrish again since Souljacker way back in 2001.
And you could hear it immediately, right?
Yeah.
Much more of that darker, rhythmic, driving Parrish sound.
Yeah, it was a fantastic injection of rock energy after the more reflective period. A great reunion. And now, most recently, Eels Time, just out in 2024.
So if you tie it all together, the sheer volume, the wild stylistic shifts from Rock Band to string quartet, the four track, it just hammers home that core truth, doesn't it?
E is Eels. He's the constant, the author, the narrator. The musicians, whether it's Cool G Murder playing bass and producing or Big Owl playing bass live, they're vital collaborators, but they serve that singular vision of Mark Oliver Everett. And beyond just the music, E's drive to process and document his life, it naturally spilled over into other things, equally compelling stuff that really cemented his narrative in the public eye.
Like his autobiography, published back in November 2007. The title alone is Pure E. Things the Grandchildren Should Know captures that mix of legacy and maybe fatalism.
It's a remarkably honest book. Often very funny, too, despite the heavy stuff.
And that book became part of the live show, didn't it? We mentioned the An Evening with Eels tour.
Where the Chet would literally read sections from the memoir on stage, blending the text with the music that came from those experiences. It makes the whole thing feel like a conversation with his own past.
But the most stunning non-musical project, the one that really brings us back to that core tension we talked about, is the documentary he made about his father.
Right. The 2007 BBC documentary, Parallel Worlds, Parallel Lives. All about Hugh Everett III and the many worlds theory.
And what's so fascinating is that it seemed like a journey of understanding for E himself. You see him talking to physicists, his father's old colleagues.
Finally engaging directly with that massive scientific legacy, that idea of infinite realities that had always sort of loomed over him. It was like connecting with his father years after his death, but through science.
It was critically acclaimed too, won a Royal Television Society Award aired on PBS's Novier over here in 2008.
And then in a classic E move of artistic economy, they even showed the documentary sometimes instead of having a support band on tour.
That's amazing. Talk about maximizing your content.
In terms of just pure pop culture saturation, Eel's music has done remarkably well getting into films and TV.
Oh, yeah. He pretty much was the soundtrack for that 2008 Jim Carrey movie, Yes Man. Didn't he have like 9 songs in that?
Yep, 9 songs, including a new one just for the film Man Up.
But the reach is wider, isn't it? You hear Eels in really unexpected places. My beloved monster is famously in Shrek.
Trax and American Beauty, Edgar Wright, used their stuff brilliantly in Hot Fuzz.
And E himself keeps popping up on camera too, embracing the weirdness of his own fame. He was in Judd Apatow's show Love.
Playing a character named Brian, doing a Paul McCartney cover. Jet.
Right. Had a little cameo in Bill and Ted Face the Music.
And then the absolute perfect piece of metacasting. His brief cameo with his dog in the opening of Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania.
A blockbuster literally all about.
Quantum realms and alternate realities. It's just perfect.
Speaking of connections, though, there's one final really devastating personal detail that ties his family story into this massive global tragedy. The 9/11 connection.
Yeah. His cousin, Jennifer Lewis, was a flight attendant on American Airlines Flight 77.
The plane that hit the Pentagon. And E writes in his book about how his father, Hugh Everett, had actually worked in the Pentagon years before.
And E wondered if the plane hit his father's old office. It's this almost unbelievable dark convergence of personal loss and world history.
Just layers upon layers.
Yeah.
On a completely different note, though, he did get some nice recognition over in the UK.
Right. In July 2014, he was given the freedom of the City of London, which feels like a long way, geographically and maybe emotionally, from that Los Feliz basement where so much of this started.
Definitely. And one final personal marker, something that must influence the more recent work, becoming a father.
Yeah, relatively late in life, at 54, his then-wife, who worked in the film industry, they had a son.
And although they later divorced, that experience, late-stage fatherhood, is just another one of those huge life shifts that inevitably gets processed through the music.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, I think what stands out most is just how clearly Eels isn't a band in the traditional sense. It really is this continuous, deeply personal, and incredibly flexible vehicle for Mark Oliver Everett.
Yeah, his entire creative output feels like this chronological, almost diary-like record of him processing these profound, often sequential life events. You see the arc clearly, the pop hints of Beautiful Freak, the necessary darkness of Electroshock Blues, then trying to find structure with that later trilogy, Lust, Loss, Redemption.
And the discography itself, with all those stylistic jumps, heavy rock, delicate strings, intimate four-track stuff, it almost serves as this strange kind of user's manual for navigating grief and complex experience, offering different perspectives through these varied musical lenses.
Which brings us right back to where we started, really. The source of his creativity and that structural tension in his life. His father's legacy.
His father proposed the many worlds theory, infinite parallel universes branching off with every choice. And E has spent his career using music to grapple with singularity, the finality of death, of grief, of loss.
So considering that lifelong search for meaning and those dramatic, rapid shifts in the music from the light of daisies to the dark of electroshock blues, from loud rock to quiet strings, will leave you, the listener, with this thought.
Are Eels albums, with all their genre hopping and emotional extremes, are they Mark Oliver Everett's way of exploring the alternate musical lives, the different emotional outcomes hinted at by his own family's scientific history? Is he maybe album by album and not just documenting one life, but actually traversing his own personal musical parallel worlds?